Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, September 16th. We are well into the beginning of the school year here at Simon Fraser University. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
And we also have Hayago here.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Hayago Marara. He's new on our team here at CJSF Public Affairs, and you'll be hearing from him a bit more today. Say hello.
Hi, everyone. Good morning.
We have a good show for you today. We have a report on the return of selective fishing to the Skeena River, fishing for salmon and other fish right on the river instead of where most of the fishing for the foodstuff we eat, and particularly salmon and whatnot, happens out in the ocean. So we have that report. Hannah Fraser will be here to tell us what you can find in the peak this week. We have Gardening with Embark. And what are you going to talk about
today,
Peter?
And I'm going to talk about the rail strike that did not happen, which is really good because CPKC, that's the other rail line,
yeah,
both haul $1 billion worth of Canadian goods daily. And I'm kind of here's a report from CN. I'm just going to give you the idea that I'm going to be a bit critical how the Teamster Union was conducting themselves, and I feel it was unfair what they were doing.
All right. Okay. Well, let's get forward with this report on the return of salmon fishing on the Fraser River, and we will. This comes to us from our friends up in Smithers, at CICK Radio in Smithers, and this is from Dan Messick.
Selective fishing in the Skeena region has a long and turbulent history. Traditional harvesting conducted by First Nations used weirs, traps, and beach seines, dip nets, and in modern times, fish wheels to trap salmon for food and economic purposes. But most of these have largely disappeared over the last decades. Selective fish harvesting is the practice of only targeting strong runs and making sure to leave weaker fish so not to impact diminished salmon populations within the system. At the beginning of the 20th century, the government and fisheries agents seized and destroyed many of these selective methods, only to be replaced by unselective gill nets, which have been the standard practice for many decades now. But selective fishing operations have made a huge comeback in recent years, and now First Nations like Kitsilis, the Niska, Wet'suwet'en, Lac-O-Lams, and Gitnyau have all been diligently refining their selective fishing operations to provide their communities with food fish, and in some cases, when runs are strong enough, economic stability. But it's more than just that. It gives these nations hope for the future and a way to pass on the knowledge from elder fishermen to the youth. Today, I'll speak with Fred McKenzie, who runs the Kitsilis Fish Wheel just outside Terrace, and Gregory Rush, Chief Gwilitz from the Gitnyau, whose fish camp, Lac An Zoc, is in the heart of Gitnyau Nation. Stay with us.
My name is Sir Margaret Gwilitz. My name is Gregory Rush. We're at the Lac An Zoc Historic Fish Camp. And this is where we do all our fishing during the summer.
Gregory, maybe just tell me, what is all this about? What is Gitnyau doing here right now? And this is your camp, so maybe explain to me from the young fellow pulling the fish out and kind of the whole process here.
This is selective fishing at its best. It's a very simple operation. And the main species that we're catching right now is sockeye. And this young man right there, he's fourth generation. There's four generations here right now. That's his first time. So that's how easy it is to pick up this selective fishing. All the fish are put into this live fin. We call it a live fin. It's really a training tool as well. We use that to train the next generation on how to properly handle the sockeye, how to properly club them. If they club them too far back, they leave a big bruising. If they grab them by the tail and they throw, they'll sever the spine. So we teach them how to properly handle them. And right now we are doing economic demonstration fishery. And this one is a bit different process from the food fishery. The food fisheries, we can club them, but this one we have to bleed it. So during the food fishery, I asked the guys to come up here, especially the ones that are just learning. We teach them how to bleed, and now they're pretty good at it. So it's a pretty simple operation. And any, if we catch any Chinook, we let it go. Coho, we do the same thing. Not too often do we get steelhead, but we let that go as well.
Gregory, how long has this been here?
I guess they say since time immemorial. There's a, right on top here, there's a site just behind the red cabin. That there is the original fishing village. The Nass River is about 15 minutes walk down that way. They come across the Nass River and they set up camp there. That's where they do. From what I can see is they probably do trapping, moose hunting, get their winter supply. And over here, we just basically started this about 15 years ago. Back then we had dome tents. And the weather was a lot colder then. And we had my nephew, while he was in the dome tent, he heard drums beating. After everybody was already in bed, nobody brought drums up. In the following year, my grandson came up. He stayed in the trailer over here. After everybody went down, he heard drums too. Sometimes we can hear people talking, especially while we're dipping. While I'm down and I hear people talking, I look up, nobody around.
Who do you think it is?
Our ancestor.
Gregory, what strikes me is I notice quite a few of the folks that are working here are young.
Yeah.
What's the importance of, you know, making sure that young people are taking part in this?
Well, it's important for the future generation, I mean, to keep this fishery going long after I'm gone. So what I've been trying to do is try and train somebody to take over after I'm gone. That way we'll keep it, keep this fishery going. It's very important.
One thing your son said was that a lot of time other nations come to you looking for food fish. Tell me about that. you know, where are some of these fish going? Like, how does that work? And why do you support other nations that are struggling in their own territories?
It's just the right thing to do to help other nations. Right now, there are a lot of fisheries that are closed down. And they contact us to get some fish. I've met families who haven't had sockeye for 5 years and were more than willing to help me. So the way I've been doing it is we have an allocation. The first half of the allocation goes to our people. And if there's any, the next half of the allocation, we invite people to come up. And the way we've been doing it is we've been trading, where we have generators back there, so we trade for gas, groceries. Sometimes people from the coast come up, they bring halibut, seaweed, clams, crabs, just to trade. And it's working. Like the always. That's what we're continuing right now.
That was Gregory Rush, Chief Gwillets from the Gitnyau Nation. Coming up next, my conversation with Fred McKenzie, who runs the Kitsilis Fish Wheel.
Hey, my name's Fred McKenzie. Right now we're in the Kitsilis Canyon, which is about a 25-minute boat ride from the city of Terrace. And And behind me is a selective fishing device called the fish wheel.
Fred, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the fish wheel. How long have you had it in, and what does it do?
Right now we've had the fish wheel in for, I say, about two months in total. And right now what we're using the fish wheel for is we're supplying the community, the band, with Section 35 food fish. Right now we're only targeting sockeye. And all the other species are being live released back into the Skeena. And on average, we could with water conditions being in our favor, the wheel can catch anywhere from 250 to 500 sockeye a night. Right now, with the water conditions being so low and clear, it has slowed down quite a bit, but we're still meeting the community's requirements for food fish.
Fred, could you explain that the whole process? How does this actually work?
Okay, right now the whole Skeena River is coming down this one channel. And it's over years of experimenting in the canyon with fish wheels, we have found certain points that are more productive at a certain time of year for sockeye. So what we do is we position the fish wheel to where we've had success in the past. But since the canyon is so deep, we want to pick a spot to where we know we have a little shelf below the wheel. Like above this, about 20 feet above this, there's a little rock shelf that kind of comes up. So we wanted to put it there. And then when the water conditions got a little cleaner, our catch started to get smaller and smaller, so we started experimenting with different methods of, like I say, coaxing the fish in to the fish wheel.
This is clearly a pretty sophisticated, big operation going on here. Fred, why has Kitsilis decided to move forward with these fish wheels?
We started out using fish wheels before in the early 90s. But back then, there was such an abundance of sockeye, we were allowed to do inland commercial fisheries. But as time went on, we wanted to be more, I guess you can say, the higher-ups were becoming more concerned with a lot of the different species on the Skeena being of concern. So we're utilizing our selective fishing history to supply food fish to the community and to let the non-targeted species go and
Fred, it would seem that selective fishing methods are making a huge comeback in the Skeena. A number of nations are now focusing on this more and more every year. But of course, over the last number of decades, gill nets have been the standard. How are people in the community reacting to the new fish wheels being back in the water?
So far, the community has been 100% behind us. They're very supportive of us catching fish and bringing it up to them. I mean, it's who wouldn't want to get a phone call or a text saying you have 20, 30 sockeye showing up for you. It's a lot less work, and people are getting the food fish they require for the winter.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to our friends at CICK in Smithers for that report. Here at CJSF, we are bringing on board our own full-time journalist who's going to support programs like this with a lot more local reporting and bringing, I think, a new strength to our broadcast here at CJSF. I hope you like this show. And you'll be seeing some benefit coming from that pretty soon with our new reporter, Ellen Taylor. All right, Dan Mangan has a new release out. It's kind of a re-release called Being Somewhere, originally released in 2002 and now released with some remixes and covers. From that album, this is Call Me Up High.
If you're lost in your vices and you need to love someone, babe, I ain't perfect, but I'm pretty good. Clutch in a crisis and free to be certain. If you just need someone who'll answer, well, you know I could. Call me up high.
Dan Mangan and Call Me Up High. He's got going out on tour next month and November, although it's a small tour. A few shows in the BC area. The first one is on Pender Island, and then some later on in Lake Country and Tofino in November. So look out for that. Don't see any Vancouver shows on his schedule for now, but I'm sure those will be coming. Welcome to Hannah Fraser.
Thanks so much for having me back.
From The Peak. With The Peak is, of course, SFU's student newspaper, out every Monday. And Hannah's here to tell us about what are some of the big stories this week.
That's right. Just one really quick thing I wanted to mention is our promotions coordinator and assistant have been doing a lot of great work on Instagram recently, like creating a bunch of new reels. So I'd highly suggest anyone listening to check that out, as we're going to be creating a lot of new content this semester.
Great.
The handle is thepeak@SFU. And, you know, since like Bill C18, like our Instagram, our old Instagram kind of, you know, lost its following, we couldn't really be as active on social media. So it's just great to see.
You're in the same situation we are, where your website and main accounts got blocked on meta platforms. So Facebook and Instagram, which makes it, well, harder to reach out in the way everyone sort of expects to happen this year. So you've got some alternate places where people can find you. What's that Instagram again?
The Instagram is thepeak@SFU.
Great. So what's in The Peak this week?
So in news this week, our news writer Caitlin Kingsmill has written a piece about the SFSS Fall Kickoff Music Festival, which returned after like the 5-year hiatus that it had. Specifically, like what people can expect at the festival in terms of entertainment and like why it took so long for the festival to return. Another story in news this week is that there was a protest for Palestine held at the SFU Employee Appreciation Barbecue. That's written by staff writer Tam Nguyen and myself. Until Tam brought this to my attention, I had no idea there was a protest for Palestine at the barbecue. So this was a pretty interesting story to work on. And it was interesting to hear from SFU that they've been working a little more towards divestment now.
Great.
We've also got some awesome stories about the SFU Verheyen Lab making a breakthrough in reversing Parkinson's.
Right.
And an SFU BD student, Vansh Sobti, creating his own anxiety hoodies with student mental health in mind. We often report on some pretty serious, like sort of dark stuff in news. So it's just nice to have some success stories this week.
That's great. I'm curious about those anxiety hoodies. We won't do a spoiler. You'll have to go to The Peak to actually find out how hoodies are going to help people with their anxiety.
That's right.
Good stuff. How do people find The Peak on the web?
You can read our weekly issue by picking up a print copy at a Peak newsstand near you, or read our stories online at the-peak.ca. You can also view our full digital issue all at once at issuu.com/peaksfu.
Right. And of course, physical copies are available here on the SFU campus, but also on the downtown campuses at Woodward's and Harbor Center.
Yes, that's right.
You don't have to come all the way up to Burnaby Mountain to grab your hard copy of The Peak.
That's right. And our cover piece this week that I just wanted to quickly mention is by Yasmin Hassan, one of our staff writers, and she writes about a film that she saw called La Suprema at the Vancouver Latin American Film Festival, which was screened here at SFU 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
The film follows Lorena, a young teenager in Cartagena, Colombia, and questions poverty and classism, as well as expressing pride in one's culture. The film also features stunning vocals from Pablo Flores, and Hassan says, if that doesn't entice you, I don't know what will. So that's sure to be a great read from our issue this week.
Great. Well, you can find all that and more in The Peak this week online and available on the SFU campus. I guess also down at Surrey. I didn't mention this.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You're going to have it down at Surrey as well. So you can get it in all those places. Thanks so much for coming up, Hannah.
All right. Thanks so much.
We'll talk to you again next week.
That's right.
Excellent.
Thank you.
It is 25 minutes after the hour here at CJSF and I guess throughout Vancouver. Next up is Bird Note. And right after that, we'll be gardening with Embark.
This is Bird Note. Once nesting season ends, these violet-green swallows seem to know it's time to party. They usually nest as single pairs in cavities or nesting boxes. But now, they gather on electrical wires by the dozens in the western United States, chattering away as part of their pre-migration networking. They're not alone. Tree swallows often join the violet greens before they all begin their southbound migration to Mexico and Central America. Cliff swallows may gather the same way, and so will barn swallows, not just in North America, but across Europe and into China too. Birds flock for protection. The more eyes watching, the greater the chance of noticing predators, and the harder it is for predators to single out any one bird. Also, birds flock to share information about where to find food. Migrating by day, swallows forage for insects as they move farther south. When they return in the spring, you won't see them sitting around on telephone wires. In spring, it's all business as the swallows start selecting their sites and building their nests. They'll save all that socializing for the fall. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It is time for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio, as he does every week, is Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability Society.
Hi, good morning. Nice to be here.
So the weather is jumping around all over the place. Last week we were talking about how hot it was. And this week...
turned cloudy, cold, rainy. And the forecast for the next week is as well a bit cold weather. Yeah. It's fall-like weather. We see that some of the trees around campus are losing their leaves, all the big maples, maple trees, the maple vines, as vine maples as well. They're all changing colors. So nature knows that fall is around the corner. And we as a gardener try to follow what nature does. So one of the things that when we garden, we follow nature signs. And then we adjust our work to whatever is happening around us. So that's kind of gardening teaches us to learn to read nature. And those teachings apply to our garden.
Great.
So, we are at the last moment.
We're in week 37.
To keep us on track. Yes. Week 45 will be the first frost. Yeah. And so now we have this time to finish harvesting all the crops, summer crops. Our tomatoes finally are start ripening on the vines.
Yeah.
So continue harvesting. The tomatoes in our garden here in the Student Union were found by the raccoons. So the raccoons have a feast with the tomatoes. So now we are harvesting and bringing indoors for ripening indoors.
Yeah.
But as well, we're thinking soon the rain will come and it's time to start planting spring flowering bulbs because we want to have some nice flowers live during the spring. So this is the time that we can start purchasing. Most of the garden centers already have daffodils, tulips, snow drops, little bulbs just to plant now. So the bulbs have time to settle in the soil.
Yeah.
And besides, when the temperature drops, we don't want to work in hard, frozen soil. Right. So it's do everything in advance. So when the first frost arrives, we just are calm and we just enjoy now the break that the nature brings us.
Right. So when you're putting in the bulbs, because you're putting them in now, they're going to come up in the springtime.
Correct.
What do you need to think about in relation to that? Because, of course, you don't want all your flowers coming up at the same time or in the same places that you might want to be planting other things. So how does that work?
Oh, yeah. So you will identify those spaces where you want to put your clumps of bulbs. So we don't plant one or two, as we will do with lettuces or vegetables. We try to plant spring bulbs in a clump.
Yeah.
So when they